Hi, I'm Dan, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to start off by thanking all the people involved in bringing me out and the people that have been real hospitable to me. Kim, I've been talking to for a few months now, right? And Dan picked me up at the airport and drove me around, gave me a grand tour, and had a continuation of that tour with Anthony and Lynn. And today Malcolm took me to lunch, and I got to see some more stuff. Vancouver is a lovely place. It really is. And I can see why they're saying it's the nicest city to live in the world. And I don't know if you probably heard that already, though. But it's a pleasure to have been given the opportunity to come out here and do this with you guys, and secondly, just the opportunity to see Vancouver. So, as I said, I'm Dan, and I'm an alcoholic, and that's not something that I really believed that I was. And I thought an alcoholic was somebody that didn't have a place to live and didn't have a job, and I was not the vision of what an alcoholic was in my mind. I just thought I really could handle my liquor well, a little bit better than most. Right? That was my idea of my drinking. Because if you could handle it like I would, you could drink like I did as well. But I learned a lot more later on. So first, I'd like to start off by saying that I'm from Santa Monica, and my home group is the, as outlined in the book, group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it meets on Tuesday nights if you're ever in Santa Monica. And it's been my home group since my first year of sobriety back in 1989. So, and that's where I met a sponsor that that changed my life. And that was an interesting comment, considering I had four sponsors before that. Right. That's not the only meeting that I attend. It's hard for me to say which one's really my home group, because I'm really partial to this big book study that's on Thursday night, and it's not so creatively named, the Thursday Night Big Book Study. And we like to refer to it as Full Contact AA. Questions are allowed to anyone, for anyone, from anyone. The format of the meeting is we're going to read one paragraph, and everybody can share on that paragraph as often and as many times as they want to share on that paragraph. As I said, crosstalk is allowed, and so it can sometimes not be for the weak at heart. It's rarely that newcomers don't like it. It's quite often that people with time don't like it, especially if they're not used to the format, because the normal AA pitch does not have a place in that group. It's in the format, and it's read by this paragraph that's read by the secretary in the beginning of the meeting, that the format of the meeting is the context of the paragraph read, and that if anything else is shared, if you get off the context of the paragraph, we're going to stop you. And people don't like to be stopped when they're sharing in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Right. We've had people storm out of there on a regular basis. But what's more important, one individual's opinion of and entitlement to what that they should be, that they're in an AA meeting and should be able to share whatever they want, or the whole group's conscience that we're going to have a discussion on the paragraph that's read. Right. In that meeting, the group's conscience comes before any individual. That has been a constant source of growth for me. Right? It's so easy to get into Alcoholics Anonymous and do whatever you do and go to your meetings and do whatever your sponsor says and hang around here for a while and say, okay, this is what AA is, and that's all there is for me. And I've worked with a lot of people with a lot of time who got just that way, thinking that Alcoholics Anonymous is only going to take me this far. Now I'm going to have to look for something to take me beyond Alcoholics Anonymous. and look for therapy, and look for various spiritual paths, men's groups, all this other peripheral stuff that gets brought into Alcoholics Anonymous. And the sad thing is that my experience was that it was hard to find someone that knew anything about the 12 steps in 12-step programs. Mm-hmm. And that's why I went through 5 sponsors in the first year. I didn't know the first 4. I didn't know that there was anything better than the first 4 that I had. I just know that it wasn't holding my interest. And I got to the point where my ideas were that I was going to have to figure out what's really going on here, because I wasn't really getting it from the meetings or the sponsors that I was working with. I had a couple sponsors where I was telling them what I think I should be doing. Right? But that's me. And the bad part was they listened. Right? And the fact is that a lot of people don't know how to sponsor people in Alcoholics Anonymous. They know how to be a friend. They know how to listen to their problems and how to be compassionate to those problems, right? And sometimes offer some great advice, right? But I think that... I guess I want to start off with that kind of direction, because... You know, we're so used to looking at the steps in a linear fashion, with 1 at the top and 12 at the bottom. I like to look at it more like a clock face, right? With 12 back to back with 1, and you know, because when I'm working my 12 step, when I'm working with somebody else, and we're talking about their first step. Right? There's something that happens when I'm working with someone that was like me. A lot of people look at that from a different perspective when they talk about singleness of purpose and one alcoholic working with another alcoholic. They think that that person is an alcoholic, needs an alcoholic to talk to them. I kind of think that's backwards. I kind of like the idea or believe more that what happens is that I, as someone with time, and knows how to work with people, need to go back and work with people that were like me and hear their perspective, because their perspective is like fresh right out of the pits, right? And as we're sharing experiences and I'm listening to them talk to me about what they've gone through, right? I connect at a deep spiritual level, because they're talking about my old life, right? They're talking about the way I used to be. So even though we're going to start in the introduction and work through 1, and this is all really about the 12th step for me, because it's about having a deeper understanding of what our program's about, and hopefully maybe get some people excited about doing some more, right? And more would be being brought to a place where I could share that experience with people. At more than just an intellectual level or more than just a psychological level, right? But it is really at a spiritual level, and to find out what that really means, right? And so those are my 2 main groups, the Tuesday night as outlined in the book and the book study. And I'm there every week at both of those meetings, and I work my life around those meetings, you know. And just because I have 22 years of sobriety, I don't believe that the meetings are any less important for me. I think that a fellowship has a lot of a big part in this whole thing. I mean, if you look at, I don't know, does the Canadian book still have the circle and the triangle? It's out of the Canadian book too? Okay. Yeah, they took the circle and the triangle out of that title page many years ago. Well, they took this circle and triangle out, and the problem that I see with that, it was just so useful with, there was so many ways to look at that circle and the triangle. I think that it was sad that it got taken out, really, because I, from a number of different levels, because first of all, it's a good place to start with asking, what is Alcoholics Anonymous? Right? Usually I ask that question, people just kind of like look at me like slanted, and their head slanted, like, where's he going with this? Right? Obviously, Alcoholics Anonymous is the fellowship, right? And it's the recovery program outlined in the book, and the service side of the triangle. There's three sides of that triangle that in that title page. And the unity side of the triangle, I meant, not fellowship side. So, obviously, the first contact I have with Alcoholics Anonymous was the fellowship. And I got really involved with the fellowship. And there was, I believe, a power that was working through the fellowship. Right? I don't believe that power was enough to keep me sober, but it was enough to get me started. And and I don't look for God in the group. I don't believe that people are God. But I believe that there is an underlying power that that seemed to have caught me and carried me as far as it took me. And that becomes a really good question. Not only if you're new, but also if you've got time, right? Because there's people with time that are, some of them are more uncomfortable than people that are new, right? This is, do I have a home group? Do I have a fellowship that I'm committed to, right? That I show up to on a regular basis, right? More times than not, when I'm working with someone that can't stay sober, that's the first thing to go. Is the regular meetings. Don't want to be accountable to anybody, and certainly don't want to tell them that they're not sober anymore. Right? But at another level, and I think that what Alcoholics Anonymous has that a lot of other recovery situations don't have is you can go to 30 days, 60 days, a 90-day program, a 6-month program. I've heard of 2-year programs. Right? But nothing like this where I commit to it at a deep level for just about forever, right? But I don't go to meetings because I need you to keep me sober. I go to meetings because I go for what I can bring to the meeting, right? And that's where I meet people to work with. Right? So my reasons for going to meetings change. But in another another perspective is that there's people there that are like me that I can connect with. They're close friends that I've had for a long time that are like family. People that in some ways are closer than some of my family. Right? And that becomes really important that became really important to me for long-term sobriety, right? Because it's a community that I want to be a part of, that I care about, and the people that care about me. But again, as I said, I don't believe that meetings alone can keep me sober, right? And then, because I had gone to a lot of meetings in the first few months of my sobriety, and met a lot of people and heard a lot of talk and heard things like, if you're here, you've done the first 3 steps. Right? And the fact of the matter was that I didn't really believe I was as bad as you. And I was sure that I wasn't going to be this God thing, because when I came into the program, I had trashed another business. I had trashed a marriage. She moved out just before I got sober, and in my mind there was no God that cared about me, and that's all you guys were talking about. And the back of my hair would raise. Right? So how could I have possibly have done the first 3 steps just by walking in the door? It wasn't clear what was wrong with me. And wasn't clear that I needed the solution that you were talking about, nor did I understand what that meant. Right? But I knew that I was supposed to get a sponsor, and I was told that just find someone that has what you want. Right? That was tough. Look around the room. Who has what I want? Right? Because I don't know what to look for. Right? So, what kind of car do they drive? What kind of job did they have? What does their girlfriend look like? Who did they hang with? Right? Who were they? Because I still thought that there was something that I needed to put together outside of myself that would make me feel like I thought I needed to feel, that would make me whole. Right? I still believed that the solution was out here. And as far as the God thing, as I figured I was going to figure out, I'm a smart guy, and I knew I would figure out what's really working for you guys. Right? So I burned through a few sponsors, and I ended up walking into a meeting in Santa Monica, and actually my home group, as outlined in the book meeting, where I finally met the guy that became my sponsor until he died. I met him in 1989. His name was Joe H. from Santa Monica. And he passed away in 2007, living in Brazil of natural causes, had a heart attack in his sleep, which seems actually like a good way to go to me. You know, to be fine moving around and then all of a sudden, boom, you're gone, you don't wake up. And I was used to these other sponsors that didn't really know what to do with me, or probably with anybody. But, and I started to discuss with him what I thought we needed to do. And he just kind of stopped me and he says, you know, let me just explain to you what my sponsor, Don P. from Colorado, who has always already also, I'm sorry, also passed away. Let me explain to you what he showed me. And we'll do that first, and then we can go off and play with this thing later on after you finished it the first time. And I didn't know what to say about that, because here was the first person I came across that had a plan, right? Who knew what we were going to do, and he wasn't really interested at all in what I thought we should do. And that impressed me. Amongst other things, you know, because when I started going to this meeting that he was a part of, looking back, I see what they meant by finding someone that has what you want, right? But I don't know that I was in a place to understand that until I looked back, because I saw that this group wasn't talking about staying powerless. They were talking about accessing power. They weren't talking about things like you'll never finish amends or you don't have to. They were saying you have to finish amends. Right? They were, in fact, you couldn't even speak at that meeting, or you couldn't even share. All you could do was ask questions if you hadn't finished amends, a set of amends. And that put some importance on it, right? And so he basically just, his instructions were simple. We're just going to start at the beginning of the book, read the book, but not only read the book like a novel, but read it like a textbook, and we're going to consider what it says. We're going to pray when it says pray. We're going to write when it says write, and all the instructions will come out of the book. And it was simple as that, and it sounded easy enough. But he had all these assignments for me to do along that way. Certain notes in the book and turning statements into questions for consideration. It's so easy to read the book and read Bill's story and say, poor Bill, right? He had a really bad life, right? But I was asked to go through that and just ask, did I drink like Bill? Did I think like Bill? Right? Did I feel like Bill? Right? And it put a personal experience, put my experience onto the process. Not your experience onto me or Joe's experience onto me. He wasn't telling me that I'm alcoholic. In fact, He said, you don't even really know what an alcoholic is. And that was true. He says, maybe you're not even an alcoholic. Right? And that was, I had mixed emotions about that, because if that's true, I wasted 9 months. Right? 9 months of drinking, that's what came to my mind, actually. Of not drinking. You know, but at the same time, it was scary because I had got all my AA friends you know, so there was mixed emotions there. But the truth is I never really was looking for a club to join. I didn't really necessarily like the idea that I was going to have to be an alcoholic and that I could never drink again. Right? I didn't stop because I didn't like it. Right? So he told me to pray and just set aside everything I think I know for an open mind and a new experience. And we just started going through the book asking, you know, was this me? Was this me? I mean, I had listened to a lot of speaker tapes. I had read other books that they have in the 12-step stores. I had skimmed through this book and read it, as I said, like a novel at first, never really getting much out of it. All right, but there was something different when I attached my experience to it. Right? And what I found was is that every step of the way, it was like a journey inside, deeper and deeper, looking at the truth about how I drank and where that comes from, the mental state that precedes that, and what came before that, and just each step of the way chipped away at a little bit more of the idea that I don't need God or that I don't need you people, right? And that had to be chipped away, because I was completely an atheist when I got here. And the idea of this being a spiritual program was very kind of bothersome to me. I mean, what is a spiritual program? And how can one really rely that there's a God? You know, those are all questions that came to my mind. It's like, how could you possibly even believe that this even is? How could you possibly know that this is a spiritual problem? Right? I didn't know any of that. And I had to be shown, and I had to have an experience with what all that means in order to go along with the idea that I need a power greater than myself. I found that any time I've read the book or anything I've read on God depended a lot on there being at least a little bit of an element of willingness. Right? And I hadn't had it. I mean, the only thing that ever got me to willingness was the consequences of my drinking. Right? You know those mornings where you get up and you go, God, help me. And I said, you know, you got to go to work and you've done it again and you stayed up drinking and were passed out somewhere and it wasn't home. You know, the consequences is what is... You know, of my life is what brings me to the place where I just look up and say, you know, God help. And that's from an atheist or agnostic perspective, right? Right? So it's the pain and suffering, the devastating experiences in my life that ultimately take me to God. Right? And that's what the 12-step process had to show me. You know, I remember early on that there was people in the program that didn't want you to talk about alcohol, even in meetings, or they warned against even discussing your drinking. Whereas I don't see how I could have possibly got to the place that I got to, right, by ignoring my drinking. How can you do a step one ignoring the experience of your drinking? I don't know. And that brings up another problem with the 12 steps. A lot of people are coming into the program a lot younger now. Right? They didn't have marriages to trash. They didn't have businesses to lose, homes to wreck. Right? You know, so it gets a little more complicated when you start working with some really young people. But you know, I called Narcotics Anonymous at 17 years old. And I because I was concerned about a little cocaine habit I started to pick up. You know, the tequila or the whiskey didn't seem to bother me so much, but this cocaine thing really scared me. And because I was using a gram a month. It scared me. I don't know. So I called Narcotics Anonymous. And I said, you know, I think I have this problem. And the guy started asking me some questions, and he just said, you know what? I don't think you need us yet, but keep our number. I did lose the number, but I did find it again. But this goes back to the talk about people that are young coming into the program. It's like if there was somebody there that I was talking to that would look at my drinking and the way I was living, and you know, I would have probably avoided a lot of things that turned my life upside down a lot sooner. If somebody knew enough about the situation to ask a little deeper than what I was saying, and to look around what I was talking to them about. But still, I think that in some ways I see it that getting stopped too soon could rob someone of a first step experience. That would be another problem, right? So I need somebody that could take me through this process, through the recovery process outlined in the book. I know there's other ways to do it. I know that some people like the 12 and 12. I know that some people like other literature from hospitals. I've had some experience with a number of different things, and nothing gave me the promises that are in this book from working that other stuff out of the other books. I had to do what was in this book to get these promises, and that was my experience. The other thing I'd like to say about that is there's two ways I see people coming to this. I just finished working with a guy where by 9 months he had finished the whole process with me, and is practically finished with all his amends. He's sitting on a couple of them, which we're talking about right now, but he took a year last Monday, his first year, and on that day somebody with 5 years asked him to take him through the process, right? And he's only got his first year, right? Now that's not common in most of Alcoholics Anonymous, for someone with no time to sound like they know something that valuable. And that was my experience, is by the time I had 5 years, I was hanging around a men's stag where it was frequented by people with 20 to 35 years of sobriety, and I was working with a lot of them. Right? Sometimes it's not about how much time you've got, but what you've done with the time you've been here. Right? There's people with a lot of time that don't know how to sponsor people. I'm actually going to be starting with someone with 35 years when I get back, right after, in about a month after some things get behind him. And he's not even sure if he's an alcoholic or an addict. Right? And that's a concern for him. That wasn't my concern. That was what he told me, is he doesn't know what that really means. And he's afraid to find out he's not. Right? Again, it wouldn't be for me to tell him what he is. We just start at the beginning of the book, see what the book says. You either relate to it or you don't relate to it. You know, you either see your own truth or you don't. And the reason that it's important, I believe, to see what's true for me, again, it's because I have to see what I need an act of God to save me from in order to buy this whole package, in order to go along with the whole program. And what do I need an act of God to save me from? All right. I didn't need an act of God to save me from people, places, and things. right? Need an act of God to stop me from drinking again, right? And anyway, I got off the track. Sorry. We're talking about this guy with that. This one guy has a year. I caught him right at the beginning before he got any, picked up any bad habits, and it was good because he was a sponge. And people that are new sometimes are easier to work with than people with time. Right? But I get a lot of people with a lot of time that have not never gone through the steps in a thorough way, and I see that there's a lot of old ideas to work around, and you know, you've been here a long time. I see this in myself. My ego attaches to what I know, and I believe I know the real truth about the real truth. And sometimes that's what can block me from growing, which is why I continue to go through the process on a regular basis. I'm not living off of my first pass through the 12 steps, but I meet people with time in the program that really haven't done too much. Right? And I can't tell you how many times I've worked with people that nobody want anything that they had to offer. They go through the process, and now they know how to work with people because they've had the experience of going through the process themselves. And all of a sudden, people start asking them to work with them. Right? So some people are attracted to just time, but there's a different message when you really have a deep understanding of this process, and I'm not one that would stand up here and preach that there's a right way and a wrong way, right? And I know some people like to do that, and I know that it's hard to stay out of that sometimes because I was there. I ran around with my big book, and if you disagreed with me, I'd hit you over the head with it, right? Telling you what page and what paragraph exactly what contradicts what you said, right? You know, and what I had to realize, those people that weren't doing it right are still sober. And who am I to say someone's staying happy and sober wrong, right? Nor do I attract everybody in my city to work with me. They actually attract people to them. Right? Go figure, right? The fact is that Alcoholics Anonymous somehow has created this enormous net, and there's a place for everybody. And don't confuse me saying that I agree with what some people do, right? But I'll attract the people that want what I have, and they'll attract the people that want what they have, and somehow, hopefully, it'll all balance out spiritually, right? And having a real tolerance for other people's viewpoints and shortcomings are what makes me more useful to people with time. Because if I take a hard stand and come at you and saying you're doing it wrong, and you might not even be an alcoholic, and you've got twice as much time as I have, you know, it's not very well received. Right? But I did that when I was young in sobriety. I did that. I was guilty of that. And I come to the realization that maybe all this technical information and this deep thought about the 12 steps and how it works and all the way my mind digs into this, maybe that's really not a testament to how much healthier than them that I am, but maybe more of a testament to how much sicker I was than they are, and they just were able to come here and get it at a simpler level. Right? But what I realized, and I mentioned it slightly a moment before, but the thing that gets me to God is not virtue. Right? When I really understand what's wrong with me and the desperate nature of my problem, right, and my inability to change the way I'm living on my own, right? It's that desperation that takes me to God, right? And the more desperate I feel, the harder I'm going to turn to God, right? So it's really important that I understand what this says here, at least for someone like me that has a problem relying that there's a God that'll work in my life. right? You need to prove it to me. Show me what that's going to do for me and why I need it, right? Right? Because I wasn't born wanting to just have a life full of God, right? That wasn't my path. You know, I wanted to be God, right? You know, so on a number of different levels, the 12-step process had to bring me to this place that I could really, really surrender to that idea. And then it had to continue to prove it to me. It showed me how to access the power and direct the power and live with that power. All right? And that'll probably come up tomorrow. All right? Because it's so easy, even if you feel like you have a spiritual program, right, it's still hard to get that idea out of the back of your head. At least for me it is that idea that, you know, maybe there really is no God. Right? And I have to get to the place where I've gotten far enough and deep enough into the process where it gets proven to me over and over again. Right? First, that there is something I can turn to, and then proof that it'll work in my life. Right? And the fact is that I don't always see that proof in my own life. Right? I'm like the last person to see my own growth. But you know, when you're working with someone, you know, like this new guy that I'm working with, who's a pleasure, by the way, you know, because he hangs on every word I say, and you know, yes, there's a little ego involved, okay. You know, it's just he steals my stuff, so I can't share after him. But you watch how they come in to the program, and you watch their lives transform through the process, right? And it wasn't that anything I did. It wasn't like I can't keep him sober. I can't fix his life. I just showed him what I do in this book, right? And something else transformed his life, and he became what he became. And that was between him and God. And he is, and I see that in him, right? And I see proof. I see the proof of the power of this program and the power of God working in his life, right? Much quicker than I see it in my own, right? But nonetheless, if I didn't have this program to continually prove that to me, I would stray. I know that. Because I seem to default into self-will. Right? I seem to default into running my own life. Right? Which is why the third part of that triangle, the service side, becomes so important. Now, a lot of people like to look at that service side as what they do in the meetings. Thing is, when you read this book, they're not going to talk much about meetings. I think there's one sentence referring to meetings in the whole front of the book. The service side that they were talking about in the beginning and through this book, and not because I'm saying that what you're doing for Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole is bad, it's part of it. I just, in this context and going through the big book, I bunch all of that stuff that you do in meetings and that service work is participating in the fellowship, setting up chairs, making coffee. Some people call it service. I call it being a part of your fellowship, being a part of your home group, right? Right? Because working with others is what they found right from the beginning that did more for them than anything else. And a lot of people have excuses why they can't do that. One of the big ones is I don't know how to do it. Right? Well, there's a way around that. There is a way around that. You know, and it's a very organic process. You know, you just have to do it yourself first. Right? You know, and then you just do the same thing with someone else. It's that simple. So when I had this deep experience with this 12-step process, I moved into that service side with a conviction that I really had something that I wanted to share, right? And a lot of people miss that, and that's sad. And I'll talk more about that tomorrow, too, I don't know, about the kind of instructions I give my people when we get into step 12, right? You know, because the excuse that nobody ever asked me is not a very good one, considering what they went through in the beginning to find people to work with. Because in the beginning, they had to go pull them off of bar stools, which didn't work so well, but going to hospitals and being referred to people, going out and finding people. You don't have to put that much work into it these days. You go to a meeting and they show you who they are, because meetings, they any newcomers, you know, right? Right? So we'll talk about, you know, I mean, I'm in a sales business. If I was able to pose a question to a group like this, who's interested in what I have to sell, and they raise their hands, I'd be on you, right? I wouldn't be waiting for you to come to me. Right? Anyway, we'll get more into that tomorrow. But it's that service side. What should I talk about with that? I think where I'm going to go to with this now is those are three really important questions to start off with. Where am I with my fellowship? Do I have one? Am I committed to a group? A lot of people are. Some people absolutely are not. Right? Am I familiar with the recovery process outlined in the book? Am I in it? Am I working it? You know, there's stuff to do constantly with that recovery process. And am I looking for people to work with? And how effective am I? Or do I feel that I fall short in that and I need to do better? Right? That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. And I can't tell you how many people I meet that don't know what to do with people. And so they're not working with people. They couldn't tell you what's in this book, right? But they have meetings they go to regularly, because that's where they have to go to dump their unsolved problems, because they're living in a powerless lifestyle, and it takes a lot of power to live powerlessly, right? You know, without an alcoholic without a solution is a tough way to live. Right, and many people in the program resort to therapy and all kinds of things. And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying therapy is bad. It has its place, right? But ultimately, they'll refer you. If you're an alcoholic, they'll refer you back to us anyway, right? Because even if therapy shows me the truth about something, I still don't have the power to do anything different, right? And this is what this is about. This is about learning how to access some power and how to direct that power and use it in my life. So I use the contents page in the book to kind of lay out a plan of action. I call the front of the book, for lack of a better word, just the general information of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's a couple important points that I think I'd like to stress. And that's everything in the Roman numerals page. There's a lot in there. I actually have a CD with me reading all of that that I can, if somebody's interested, I can show you, tell you where to download it off the internet for free. Can get to that another time. But there's just so much in here. But the part that I think becomes really important is the part where Bill first goes to Bob. And on page XV, if you have your books and you want to follow along, it says the spark that was to flare into the AA group, that's the first AA group, was struck in Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker and an Akron physician. Does everybody know what kind of physician Dr. Bob was?
Proctologist.
Right. Can you imagine if you had an alcoholic problem and someone referred you to a proctologist? You'd have to really want to get sober, wouldn't you? But the interesting thing about that is Bill was a stockbroker when you didn't have to be licensed to be a stockbroker. He was actually a stock speculator. So people really had to trust your ability. right? And Dr. Bob was specializing in a field that wasn't actually taught in school yet, right? And he was known for this specialty. That, and the point is they were very smart people, right? They were very sharp people that probably thought quite well of themselves. Does that sound familiar? 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drink obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following a meeting with an alcoholic friend, which was Ebbie Thatcher, who had been in contact with the Oxford groups of that day. The Oxford group was like a fundamentalist Christian society that was actually helping a lot of people. They thought that their program would help everybody, except Dr. Bob actually didn't want to tarnish his name in the community, so he didn't ever talk about his alcoholism with them. He kept it a secret, he thought. They all actually knew, though. And they were actually... it was no... They knew exactly that... Well, the way that situation was is that you had to stand up and admit what's wrong with you and turn to God for help with that. They didn't tell you what's wrong with you. You had to just admit it. And they were waiting for him to stand up and just say, I'm an alcoholic, and it wasn't happening. Okay, oops, that day. He had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism, who's now accounted no less than a medical saint by AA members, and whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. Okay, I would say that if Dr. Silkworth is, if they're referring to him as a saint to us, right, that would mean there's something really important about the doctor's opinion, right, that we need to know about. And that's the part that I think it's stressing here, is the importance of the doctor's opinion. And it says something here that's real important to note. It says, from this doctor, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism. Though he didn't accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, he was convinced of, and it's going to name five things: the need for moral inventory, confessions of personal defects, restitution to those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief in and dependence upon God. There's five things there, and there were six tenets of the Oxford group, right? Which means there was one that he didn't completely agree with, right? Because it says he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, but he was convinced of the need for these five things. So wouldn't it be good to know what that one is that he couldn't accept? Right? Okay, in my fourth edition, I work between a fourth edition and a third edition, so I have to figure out which pages it's on in this book. 263. All right. 263 in the fourth edition, 292 in the third edition. These are not the six tenets of the Oxford group. These were something that was adapted for early Alcoholics Anonymous, but it was very similar. The five that he could accept is 2 through 6. The one that he couldn't accept, complete deflation of ego. Can any of you guys relate to not accepting complete deflation of ego? Right? So, down the page where it starts off, the physician, Bill found himself out of town, he was in a place where he felt like he was going to drink, right? And what he had been going through over the last 6 months, he was pulling drunks off bar stools, trying to get them sober. They weren't necessarily people that wanted to get sober, but they were offered a place to stay and food, and kind of like a sober living for free. But he found himself out of town in Akron. And he started calling around to see if he could find a drunk. And he went down this long list of calls that he had put out trying to find someone that he could talk to. And one of those calls actually got him in touch with a woman named Henrietta Seebring. And Henrietta Seebring, turns out, was a member of the Oxford group in Akron. It happened to be the one that Dr. Bob was in. And Bill explained what he was looking for, that he's an alcoholic, and he needs to find an alcoholic that he can talk to in order for him to stay sober himself. And you know what Henrietta Seebring responded with? He says, "Thank God we've been waiting for you." Yes. Right? That always sends chills up my spine. And as it turns out, the Oxford group would get into these little prayer circles, and they wanted God to help Dr. Bob somehow, and they would pray for God to send something to Dr. Bob that would help him. And now she gets this phone call from Bill saying, "Hey, I'm looking for an alcoholic to talk to." Right? You know, so you know, they just looked at that as just a miracle. Now, you could say it was coincidence, you can say whatever you like, but you know, it was what it was, and that's what initiated their first meeting. The physician, we're talking about Dr. Bob, had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but it failed. So he had the solution. He was going to the Oxford group, and he was going to church, right? But I believe that just like Bill, is he couldn't accept complete deflation of ego, right? Because... But when the broker gave him Dr. Silkworth's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with a willingness he had never before been able to muster. Right? The truth about the problem, right, and the realization that he absolutely cannot stop on his own, and the desperation of that was what got him to this place where the solution could work. Just a belief in God was not enough for him, right? Because he had to believe less in himself, right, when it came to this sort of thing. He had to see that he couldn't that there was no way he was ever going to stop on his own. Desperation is what took him to God, right? He had some virtue, obviously, because he was going to spiritual venues, spiritual places like the Oxford group and church, right? Right, but something had to change at a deeper level for him to really go along with the God idea. And he sobered never to drink again up to the moment of his death. So I'd say that's really it would be really important for us to know what the doctor's opinion says about an alcoholic. Right, and that's where my step one begins. I look at doctor's opinion as the beginning of step one. More about alcoholism is where I look at step two. In We Agnostics, I look at step two. Right? And the beginning of how it works on page 58 is where I start to look at step three. After step three, it starts to tell you where the step is, right? Before that, it doesn't tell you where step one is and step two is, but after that, it does. And that was a big question that got answered for me too, because you know, there's a lot of people that couldn't tell you where step one is in the big book, right? They look in the 12 and 12. For step one, because it says step one, right? Don't get me wrong, 12 and 12 is a valuable piece of Bill's material, and Bill wrote some really cool stuff. But I believe that if there would have been more than four pages for step one, if they meant it to replace the big book, because if you really read step one in the 12 and 12 critically, it refers to you have already talked to your sponsor about this. Right, and that it's more of a something to read, I believe, when you've already understand what this is about through the Big Book. Right? It was never written to replace the Big Book. Okay. We're going to take a break until 8:30. Can we take our seats, please? Thank you. All right, so I started drinking when I was like 15 and a half. I was hanging around a gas station, and this was back in the late 60s, and there was a lot of stuff going around. There was going on at the time. There was the Vietnam War. There was hippies. There was all kinds of stuff going on, and I didn't necessarily care about any of it. Andy Warhol. Yeah. I had my little group of friends, and we would just hang outside of liquor stores and wait for someone to go in and buy us booze, right? And did the teenage thing, and by the time I was 16, I figured there was nothing left that they could possibly teach me, that I knew so much already, that I had stopped going to school. Right? I showed up in the morning for photography class, but I left right after that. I happened to like photography. I got an A in photography, by the way. but the other, and that was only for the first semester. After that, it was, I was pretty much done with school until they were done with me and kicked me out, which didn't really matter because I wasn't going anyway. So what I would do, what I was jump on my little motorcycle and drive over to the next town, which was Culver City, and honk my horn for my friends to come out because they went to a different high school. And then we'd go hang out at the beach or at the gas station that I hung out at, and basically all we did was party, and whatever that meant back then. Didn't necessarily matter what we did as far as drugs. If somebody had something, we tried it. Some of you probably relate to this. You know, you take it and say, by the way, what was that? Right? So I experimented with a lot of different things, but certain things stood out. Primarily, I really liked alcohol, right? And I actually really liked cocaine as well. Mm-hmm. And between those two things, they became like the most important thing in my life. And you know, back in the 60s, you know, there was a lot of LSD going around. There was a lot of different kinds of drugs, and I smoked pot. And there was what we had back then was these, they'd refer to as for $10 you'd get a 4-finger lid. Right? Some of you probably remember that. There's a baggie filled that high with marijuana, right, for $10. From what I understand, a couple hits is the same as smoking the whole bag, so I can't even imagine that. So it's much different now. But somebody walked up to me. Actually, my stepbrother walked up to me in this gas station. And he said, Dan, you know, you're starting sentences and you're not finishing them. And I thought, oh, that's a problem. And I didn't like the idea of that. So I told myself I got to quit smoking marijuana, and I quit. Made a decision and I quit. You know, there was other stuff. There was this, they called it angel dust. I don't know if you had that here, PCP. And I know, I didn't see any angels ever, but I kept telling myself, I've got to stop doing this. And eventually I did stop, but it took, you know, I don't know why I ever did it. Every time I did it, I said, why am I doing this? You know, but I stopped, right? I didn't need an act of God to save me from those things, right? That's the point, right? As time went on, you know, I had these dreams, these aspirations of who I was going to be and what I was going to become. I came from a family that was very fairly successful in the clothing industry. Both my grandparents, my uncles, my father. I was sure that there was nothing less for me, that I was going to be someone. And and it was kind of disturbing to finally get to the point where I'm sitting on my couch in 1987, looking at my life, going, what happened? What happened? You know, I really believe that it was just a matter of being serious and finally wanting to quit, and one day I would quit. Right? And I, you know, but I'm looking around my life thinking, you know, I was 32 years old. The wife had moved out. I was basically living in an apartment in a building that I was managing. So nobody knew that I couldn't afford to pay rent. So that's stealing, right? Although I didn't think of it as stealing at the time, because I felt that my job was so important that I deserved this, right? But then my job got so important that I thought it was even worth the paycheck, right? Which it wasn't. But I was in survival mode, because I had got to the point where, for the previous 3 or 4 years, I was drinking way out of control, doing cocaine way out of control, and to the point where I had this factory a picture frame factory, just ran it to the ground. You know, by the time I was done, it was all I could do to sell off all the equipment to pay off whatever bills I could, and just basically waste the rest of the money on alcohol and drugs, and just left me in this place of, you know, just completely bewildered by how could somebody with so much potential be in such a bad place, right? And I was sure that it was just the drugs, so I stopped the cocaine altogether, right? Always knowing that in the back of my mind that the fact was, I didn't really believe that I was going to be able to stay away from the drugs for good, because it kept talking to me. But I absolutely knew that the alcohol was such a big part of my life. I couldn't perceive a life without it, yet the consequences were becoming more and more obvious in my life, right? But I couldn't see a life without it, so I figured that just stopping the drugs would be enough, and that I would taper off with the alcohol. And that was in 1987, and I made this commitment to myself that I was going to not drink enough for there to be consequences in my life. Right? I still believed that I could do that. Drink just enough just before the consequences, right? Again, I mentioned this before, is I loved drinking. I didn't stop because I didn't like drinking, right? I hated the consequences, though, in my life, right? And I believe that if there was no consequences, it would have been really hard to do a step one. Right? Luckily, I think I was graced with consequences. Right? And I absolutely didn't understand what was wrong. You know, and that was why the doctor's opinion was so important to me. On page XXVI of the doctor's opinion, it says, the physician who, at our request, gave us this letter has been kind enough to enlarge upon his views in another statement which follows. In this statement, he confirms what we who have suffered alcoholic torture must believe. Right? Right? My alcoholic torture was being completely baffled by the impact that alcohol was having on my life. Right? And absolutely not understanding why this thing that I thought was feeding me was really bringing me to a point of, it was really starving me spiritually to death, right? Couldn't understand why I was in such total lack of control. It says, excuse me, lost my place. as follows. Must believe. Okay. That we must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. So now it's making a differentiation between my body and my mind. Right? Since it did not satisfy us to be told we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, we were in full flight from reality, or were outright mental defectives. These things were true to some extent, in fact, to a considerable extent with some of us. I believe that is all true for me. But those are all things that went on in my mind. Right? Those are things I think that they're making a differentiation between that this is what's going on in my mind, but let's look at the physical results of your drinking. Forget about what you're thinking about drinking. Forget about the obsessions. Forget about any of that stuff. Just look at the facts. Right? It says, but we are sure that our bodies were sickened as well. In our belief, any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out this physical factor is incomplete. Right? So, what does normal drinking look like? I know, wrong crowd to ask, right? You know, my grandmother, you know, everybody used to always buy her booze for presents for Christmas and whatever, and she always used to say, I don't know why people buy me all of this stuff. It was always the sweet stuff, the Baileys, And I remember one day she got this, like, giggle, right? She says, you want to get drunk? And I thought, oh, God, no, not with my grandmother. So she took a couple little glasses and poured a couple drinks, right? And I figured, okay, and it was that Bailey's, I think. Yeah, it was Bailey's. And she took a couple sips, and I took a couple sips, and she took a couple sips, and I took a couple sips, and I think it went back and forth a couple times like that. And then she got this smile and this little giggle, and she says, She says, I'm starting to feel it. I better stop. All right? Starting to feel it, I better stop. That's so backwards to me. Doesn't it start when I'm starting to feel it? Right? But that doesn't necessarily make me an alcoholic. Right? See, she can drink whenever she wanted without any consequences. Right? She could take. She didn't have any problem with that, and many people don't, right? So the doctor's theory that we have an allergy to alcohol interests us. So what was an allergy back when they wrote the book? Do you know there wasn't any allergy doctors back then? Right? You couldn't go to a grocery store or a drugstore and see 10 feet of allergy remedies. They didn't have them. If a child had an allergy to something in the environment, the family would have to move or do something. It was just there was no cure for it, and it was different then too, because what an allergy was is a reaction to a substance that doesn't affect other people in the same way. And I thought, yeah, that's just like my drinking, right? And it also, if someone was like allergic to bee stings and they got stung by a bee, they'd have to rush them to the hospital and poke a hole in their throat so their throat didn't close up because they could suffocate and die. People died from allergies. They still could without the right medication, right? But back then it was a life-threatening problem that affected some people in ways that didn't affect others, right? So from that perspective, I can relate to having an allergy for alcohol. It's a physical reaction. Much like if you're allergic to grass, some people can't, I can't sit in grass without starting to itch. You know, is it got anything to do with what I'm thinking? maybe afterwards I shouldn't have sat in that grass. but it was a completely physical reaction. Now, if you went to a scientist or a doctor and said, they say I have an allergy to alcohol, you know, maybe they wouldn't completely agree with that. There's probably conflicting ideas as far as whether we're really allergic to alcohol, right? But keeping in mind that they didn't necessarily completely understand what an allergy was back then, right? It was certainly like an allergy for me, that I have a sensitivity to a substance, to alcohol, that affected me like it didn't affect a lot of my friends. And for me, it was definitely life-threatening. And I couldn't do anything about it. There was no cure for it. Right? So as laymen, our opinion as to its soundness may, of course, mean little, but as ex-problem drinkers, we can say that this explanation makes good sense. It explains many things for which we cannot otherwise account. So when I drank, drinking became more important than anything else that I was doing. Right? Became more important than the client that I took to dinner. I can't tell you how many times that they just left me at the bar. Became more important than my wife. Right? You know, she actually thought I was cheating on her, but that didn't really come out till later during a ninth step, but I could see where she could see that, where she could think that. Because I would make excuses to stay out and not come home and tell her that I'm behind in work and I have to sleep in my office. And I did sleep in my office, so if she called, I was there. Right? But I wasn't alone. And I'd have a bottle of Jack Daniels with me. Right? You know, and the level of trust that I was able to maintain with her was almost scary. Right? And the fact is that when I drank to the point regularly that the consequences in my that the amount I drank affected me and my life, and I had consequences in my life. Right? People that control alcohol usually, you know, may not get consequences in their life. Some can, right? But, you know, there's people that I knew that when they had consequences in their life from the way they were drinking, they would just say, I can't do this because the results are so bad that I can't do this. And, you know, but there was some kind of disconnection with me because I really believed when I set out to drink that I was going to not go out, get out of control. Right? It wasn't until I looked at the doctor's opinion that this started to click for me, and the idea that I can't start drinking without that thing happening. Right? That was what made Dr. Silkworth such a medical saint to our society, and what Bill talks about in the general information of the book. Right? That's why what he said was so important to bring to Dr. Bob, and later those two brought that information to Bill Dodson, the attorney, the AA number 3. I have to know what I'm up against, right? I have to know that I can't start drinking without losing control, that I can't start drinking without consequences, right? You know, and what follows the doctor's opinion is Bill's story, and Bill's story is really an important experience for me to have when I was instructed to read Bill's story, underlining everywhere where I relate to how he felt, how he drank, how he thought, felt, and drank. And I read Bill's story, setting aside the differences. I wasn't in the service in a foreign town where I had my first drink. I was in a gas station in Culver City, right, drinking with with other teenagers. Right? But that's where I felt like I was a part of life at last. But the thing about Bill's story is, as I'm going through it, underlining how where it started, I write in the notes next to, in the margins next to Bill's story, how I relate to Bill's story. So next to where he says he was in the service, there I was in the gas station, and so. And you'll see as you go through Bill's story, there's a progression of his drinking. This is where it started. You know, this is my life with alcohol when it just seemed to be the way, you know, when it was important to me, right? And somewhere around the page 4, it starts to take a turn and decline until he hits this bottom on page 8. So there's this curve. And if I can relate to Bill's story and underline a lot and make little notes in the margins all the way through, hopefully what I've ended up with is this is where my drinking started. This is what happened to it, right? And then this downturn near the end of my drinking and how much I tried to stop. See, it's going to be hard to see the depth of my hopelessness when I focus on how much I enjoyed drinking and how much I drank. I have to at some point get to the point where I have to see that it got to the point in 1987 where I made some firm commitments that I was going to drink differently. Right? This has to stop. It stopped the drugs, but for the next 2 years, I found myself walking to the liquor store over and over again, baffled by why I was still doing it. Right, because there's a question that has to be asked. It's why is it if I see that I had consequences for how much I drank, why did I keep drinking? Why did I keep going in spite of losing businesses and trashing relationships and marriages? Actually, you know, knowing that that it was affecting my life, why was it still so? Why couldn't I change the way I was living? You know, I'd go to sleep telling myself, I've got to stop doing this. And before I'd even open my eyes in the morning, just as I'd wake up, the first thought that would come to my mind was, when am I going to get up and walk to the liquor store and get some more whiskey? Right? And that situation went on for the next 2 years, that kind of thinking. Where I found myself talking out loud, walking to the liquor store, just, why do I keep doing this?